welcome to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Dan Roth, and I'm joined this week by Mike Harley.
Booyah!
And Jeff Ross.
Hello, guys.
We are brought to you by TireRack.com, the leading online source for tires and so much more, including a large selection of winter tires. And spring is coming, so they'll have performance summer tires as well, and aftermarket wheels, suspension, and brake components, and those items that make it easier to see, like windshield wipers and replacement lighting. So no matter what your vehicle, check them out at TireRack.com. Now, Jeff, you're driving something that is supposed to be from the 60s, and anything that was alive in the 60s is actually in its 60s now. That's not entirely true, but go with it.
Whoa, I don't understand what was just said.
Just tell me you're driving.
Well, the Beatles from the 50s, technically, I think, or the 40s?
The 30s.
World War II.
Yeah, before the World War
Anyway, I'm driving the 2013 Beetle convertible with the special 60s edition. And the current Beetle's neat. I mean, they've taken a lot of the, but this 60s edition is painted in a powder blue color they call denim blue, which dumps all the cuteness right back. So,
what's the engine and transmission?
It's the 2-liter turbo with the DSG. Okay, so it's pretty much like a really cute GTI.
Now, I drove one of those today, oddly enough. I drove the manual transmission one, not your 60s version, just a standard sport. And yeah, it sounded like a 5-cylinder engine. And
I can see that.
It sounded, you know, that it's got that distinctive 5-cylinder naturally aspirated drone to it. And I know it's the 2-liter turbo. It just has the oddest exhaust note. So
yeah, it's got like a little bit of a burble, but not too much that it's annoying. And then the DSG kind of gives it like a manual type feel and responsiveness, I guess. Like, it doesn't feel like an automatic.
So this is the more manly Beetle. Does it feel more manly to you, or does it still
Like I said, in this color, no.
Okay, but you called it cute, and we used to give Shunk endless crap for using the word cute.
The new Beetle, which was like the last Beetle, actually, that made. That's why I have to keep correcting people, because the last Beetle was the new Beetle. This one's
right. This is just the Beetle, right?
That's funny.
But the new Beetle made everyone think that the Beetle was cute. So when people see this now, they're like, "Oh, it's just like the old one," but it's not. This thing is fun to drive. If it came in black or red, I'd love it. And the best part, because it's the convertible, it doesn't have that whale tail anymore. Like, the entire top clumped up on the deck. Like,
yeah, but that was sort of the homage to the old Beetle convertible, the original.
At the same time, do with the function. I mean, you can't take a bubble and rip the top off of it and have a curved back end and then expect to fit it perfectly. I assume it was just how it functioned back then.
I agree with Dan. I think the original, when they reinvigorated the new Beetle in, 1998. The whole idea was to be cute and fun, and then all of a sudden Volkswagen realized, you know, we could make a lot more money if men buy the car, too. But
I don't know how many men actually bought the car. I mean, I knew like, one guy that had one, and...
And you raised your eyebrows and you saw him, right?
No, it was just fine. Rob, if you're out there, like, I hope
your
you're
father,
still...
right?
Yeah. No, not my father.
Sorry,
my
Dad.
Father had a Karmann Ghia. But that was a real Volkswagen back when they were air-cooled and completely unreliable.
But the original top had to go up there because the engine was back there.
Yeah.
Yes.
And,
you know, so it had to, that big floppy thing in a sail in the wind. But
even like this one, it doesn't fully, it's still up there, but a lot of it is hidden, and there's still a lot of usable trunk space, too. But it just gives it a cleaner look with the top down. It just doesn't look frumpy, I guess.
It's a nice top, too. Very nice top.
It's got a lot of road and wind noise in it, but this is also probably the worst week to have a convertible because we're getting really strong winds down here. So I think pretty much any car would sound noisy right now, but it just... it's extra noticeable with the fabric top.
I've noticed when I go on the freeway, they're like 60 mile an hour winds.
Enough. Enough. But so in general, though, what's your take on the Beetle? Because they've kept it alive and they've updated it and they've given it, you know, they've made it a little more squat instead of that giant arch that had, you know, it was funny, the new Beetle, which is now the old Beetle, they had that commercial that was saying, you know, oh, the arch has all this extra room inside and it's very strong. It's like, yeah, the most headroom is under the middle of the car where the passenger's knees are. So they've flattened it out, and it does look more like the original Beetle shape, and it's probably more functional. And the details in the design are a little nicer. You know, the windows are chamfered into the bodywork a little nicer. But do you feel like it's an update and it's a worthwhile car, or is it just, again, you're just like, you know, I'd just buy a Golf?
Well, I mean, I would buy a Golf, but this is a little more interesting than a Golf. I mean, Volkswagen sell, I think the Golf is what, like, the top selling car in the world. So this is something for the people that don't want that car but still want the same basic package.
You buy a Golf, you become absolutely invisible. It's the symbol for anonymity or something. And the Beetle has character. You know, you turn when I'm driving down the road and I see a Beetle, I look to see who's driving it.
Really?
The Golf just disappears in my peripheral vision.
Why do you look to see who's driving the Beetle? Do you
because it's usually a young female. Yeah.
See,
honestly, come on. When you see a Beetle, do you? Are you more likely to glance at the person driving the Beetle or more likely to glance at the person driving a Golf?
Honestly, probably
not. You don't look either way, right?
I mean, I look at the Beetle because I like the design updates of it.
I like the looks. I like the new Beetle.
Yeah.
It's a good-looking car.
It does. What I'd like to see is a very high-performance version of it with all-wheel
drive.
The Beetle R.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Beetle R. And we've seen it at in concept form at a couple auto shows.
Yeah, that would be great to be reality. So what are you driving? Because I think we've pretty much exhausted anything that's remotely interesting about the Beetle.
Well, Jeff
has a point.
Well, I just wanted to point out this is the most expensive of the special editions at $32,000.
$32,000 for a Beetle's kind of dear.
Yeah, the 50s edition is $26,000. And then the 70s edition is $28,595. But apparently the 60s was the best, so they charge more for it. So it's
$32,395.
Wow. Go 60s.
That is a lot of money for a Beetle. I mean, think of the amount of Passat that buys. That buys like an SEL.
That buys, you know, leather, the whole nine yards.
Yeah.
But once again, you're invisible in a Passat. A Beetle's a statement. And you buy a Beetle, a Beetle's a lot. In fact, the Beetle's one of those cars, I'm going to argue, that like the Mini Cooper, you have no idea what the net worth of the individual driving the car is. You know, someone in Beverly Hills will drive a Beetle just because they think it's cute, like they drive a Mini Cooper. And a Prius, same thing.
Now with the Beetle, you can get all the Golf's engines. So you can get the Turbo, the TDI. I think it's a pretty cool little car.
Okay. All right. So, Mike.
And now you're going to ask me what I'm driving.
Yeah.
And I told you a few minutes ago that I'm frustrated because you always catch me these bad weeks. I was driving an Aventador, an RS5, and now I've got an Acura ILX.
That is neither an Aventador or an RS5.
No, public transportation, though.
And I'll come out and say I used to be a huge fanboy of Acura. I've bought three of them brand new, you know, a GSR, an Integra RS. And so I was actually looking forward, and I'll let the readers know this is part of a compare we've got coming up between the Buick Verano Turbo and the Acura ILX. And they asked me, which one do you want your driver for a week? We'll give the other one to Drew. And I said, I'll take the Acura, no brainer. And I've been kind of disappointed. This is the quote-unquote top-of-the-line premium model. It's got the 2.4-liter VTEC, 201 horsepower, manual, six-speed manual transmission. But the more you drive it, the more I keep referring to it as just a Honda. And,
well, because that's what it is. I mean,
it's just a nice Civic Si.
I do have to say,
$5,000 more.
I like the ILX. I drove it and I liked it. I liked the interior. I liked the way it looks. I liked the way it went down the road. But it just still doesn't feel like it's an Acura. It feels like it's a Civic. And I drove the hybrid, so my results are skewed by that a little bit. But it was just like, this car doesn't really have the verve that I would expect in it.
Well, I liked the ILX until it came to questioning who would buy it. I mean, like you said, it's just a really nice Civic. So who's ever buying it is probably just after the badge. So
it is so much a Civic, and you know, I hand washed it yesterday over the weekend, and when I'm sponging the thing down, drawing it, all of a sudden you start looking at the panel caps and the cost cutting and just the way the headlights are assembled. It's just not a it's a sticker's just over $30,000. It's not a $30,000 car when you can get, you know, everything from a Volkswagen CC to, you know, maybe you can go in and find an Audi A3.
You can get a 60s edition Volkswagen Beetle.
Yeah, I mean, they're just...
with just as much horsepower.
The build quality is better, and just, it's light, it sounds tinny when it starts up. The best thing about it is I absolutely love revving the engine up to, you know, 7,200 RPM, whatever it is, and snap it through the gears. The transmission's great, engine's great, everything else, it's just a Civic Si. And
but it's
a Civic Si.
Yeah, it's a Civic Si. I mean, it has that sort of Acura interior, and I guess that's the only thing that I would expect that would sort of differentiate it. But the ILX didn't feel like an Acura interior to me.
The big problem also is that Honda took so much grief for the interior of the Civic that they updated it for 2013. The ILX is still the old interior, and it does have the Acura interior, but it's not as nice as the new Civic. And now, in its defense, Acura has already announced that they are going to upgrade the ILX as well. But right now, you know, if you walked into the showroom, you know, you're looking at a nicer Civic Si for $25,000.
Yeah, that's a lot of money for that car. And I wonder how well the ILX is selling. Just
not very well.
Especially for like $30,000-something, it's not that much of a stretch to get into a pretty well-equipped TSX.
Yeah, we didn't have it. We were doing the buy the numbers. And they were calling out the individual cars, and the ILX isn't selling. I think it was something like the Verona was selling three times as much or something.
When you're being outsold by Buick, you, as an enthusiast mark like that, like, because Acura always holds themselves up as some sort of contender that can run with the big dogs like BMW. And sometimes they can, like cars like the TSX, I feel like they can. They can credibly make a statement in that segment. But the ILX, no. And when Buick's kicking your tail, that might say something about you, both what Buick has done, which is pay attention and come out with a good product, and what Acura has not done, which is the very same thing.
Yeah. And I don't know. I'm stuck driving it for another day or two, and then I get a Raptor. So
yeah, I was not impressed with the Raptor.
I'll go from there. Well, it just gets me off the ground, which is nice.
Yeah,
so
that's true. That's true. I mean, what do you think? I don't want to give away the whole comparison test, but Verano.
Well, here's the deal. We took the Verano turbo manual transmission against the ILX premium manual transmission, both of them sticker priced within $1,000 of each other. We ran them on a 200-mile test loop, went from sea level all the way up to 5,000 feet, which is actually where you start hitting snow in Southern California this time of year, and brought them back down in traffic and sat down with three guys and hashed it out on which car we'd actually prefer for put in our garage, which we'd buy, and which one we'd prefer for a drive cross country, and we came up with an answer. And the results will probably be—I think the story runs in about 2 weeks, right after Geneva. Right now, we'll get lost if we pushed it up during Geneva, but it was surprising because I think one of the first lines in the story, and I could probably give away my lead at this point, is that had this you know, had the comparison between a Buick and an Acura taken place 20 years ago, it would have been an Acura Integra versus a Buick Skylark.
And the Skylark.
And that is such a crazy comparison because Google, you know, 2003 Buick Skylark or 1993 Buick Skylark, and you'll have a heart attack.
That was N-body. That was the funky, stupid-looking...
Bullet-nosed.
Integra back then was at the, you know, arguably at the top of their game. You know, this is when there was the Integra, there was the Legend. They hadn't really come out with a Vigor yet. It was just like, wow, what a bunch of great, great cars. And someone had said, you know, had we announced, you know, at Autoblog, been back before the internet, had we announced that, hey, you know, we're going to compare a Buick to an Acura, everyone would say, oh, you're out of your mind. And, I mean, because the Skylark was just a piece of junk, but...
Yeah. Hey, anyway, here Editor Neff had an N-body. He had an Achieva for quite a while, which is not that far off from the Skylark.
But, you know, here we are 20
years. What does
that say? I'm not going to tell you who wins the comparison, but it'll be a fascinating read, I promise.
Did you guys at least have a good disagreement? Because good disagreements are the grist of the mill.
We had disagreements, but as every mile rolled under the chassis, at one point we got to a rest stop and we got out and everyone was fighting over one set of keys. And at that point I said, okay, that's it. We're all throwing the towel in. So.
Yeah. Well, it could be worse. I mean, you could be driving, a Yaris. That car's not anywhere near as exciting as those two. So there you go.
Someone posted a link to the Skylark.
Yeah. hilariously bad.
It was better. There was a two-tone version, which is even better, like a seafoam mist green.
Yes, and it had the cladding with the gray along the bottom.
Like four-spoke wheels, something really classic.
But you could get that car with, like, back in the early 90s, you could get it with a 3.1 V6 in it, which was just a ridiculous amount of power for that chassis that was completely underdeveloped. And those cars were a lot lighter than cars that size are now. Mm-hmm. So it was just sort of like a boil the tire machine, you know, it's just a crazy sort of like bucket of parts that were kind of designed to operate, but not really operate well together. That's pretty much GM from 1980 to bankruptcy.
Kudos to GM. And the other interesting thing, and I'm going to mention this in the story, is that the entire comparison, we kept calling the Acura Honda, and we never once called the Buick a Cruze, and which was interesting. So, you know, Buick's done a really good job turning the Cruze into an upscale vehicle that, you know, you never sit there and stutter on the words and say, wait a second, I'm just driving a Chevrolet here. No, you know, it's a nice Buick. So,
yeah. Well, we have a rollicking good garage this week. I'm driving Toyota Tacoma.
A taco.
Yeah. All of our cars, it's funny, all of our cars are within a couple $1,000s of each other. This is a $32,000 truck. And I'll just let that sink in. When you picture the Tacoma in your mind, and then picture $32,000.
And this is why we'll never see a Ford Ranger.
Right. And realize that $32,000 buys you an F-150.
A decently loaded F-150.
Yeah. I mean, 32 grand buys an awful lot of full-size pickup. And so when you get in the Tacoma, and this one's an access cab too, so you're actually paying more for less usefulness out of this truck. And the access cab is the old sort of flip down seats. They have a crew cab model too, but the Tacoma can get hilariously long. If you start adding like the long bed with the four door cab and stuff, it just gets ridiculous.
Well, yeah, it looks bigger than a Tundra.
Yeah.
At that point.
Well, and they are bigger than the old T100s, which was their first sort of larger truck. I like the size though. It's a nice, it feels like classic Tacoma, classic Toyota truck. You know, you sit a little bit too low to the floor. It's nice and compact feeling. You know, it's a cozy little truck to drive around if you're just the only person driving it. It feels like, I'm going to sound like an idiot if I say this, but it's almost like they put a little Lexus into the Tacoma. Yeah, see, that sounds stupid, doesn't it?
I'm not going to comment.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So refinement was the thing that I noticed, though. Like the switchgear for the climate controls, right? You reach out and you turn them, and they all feel pretty tight and high quality, and they all feel the same. You know, like if you turn the temperature control versus the airflow control, they all have the same kind of action. You know, that's one of those geeky car things that nobody else cares about, but you, and when you start to notice it, you realize that's attention to detail. It has the V6, so while it also costs like a big truck, it drinks like a big truck. Because I got 17.5 miles to the gallon with this. So that doesn't really make its case. And the transmission shifts all the time. It's like jumping for the high gear, doesn't want to downshift. There's not much of a manual gate. And it feels sluggish on the road because it wants to cruise at like 60 all the time. It's just sort of like where it naturally feels like. It's a chore to keep up if you're not using cruise control on the highway. So,
right.
I don't know. It feels like an old truck kind of because it's an old truck, but it's not horrible for its class. I mean,
well, that's not saying much about the class either.
Well, yeah. I mean,
the Tacoma's the newest truck in that class, I think.
Frontier. Yeah, the Tacoma may have been
old.
Updated. The Frontier just feels more lively to me, and it's a little bigger. So I would trade the refinement of the Tacoma for the actual usefulness of the Frontier. But then again, you look at the money and you go, I'm just going to buy a full-size truck. And I think that's why Chevy's the only one still doing it with the Colorado and the Canyon on GMC. And that truck is... That's probably the oldest truck in the set.
Well, and they're bringing a new Colorado and Canyon or whatever it's going to be called.
Yeah. Ouchie. I don't know. It's weird because it's actually a pretty decent truck to drive. You know, it's not so big that it feels all ungainly and clumsy. It handles decently for a pickup truck. It rides okay. This one was four-wheel drive with the TRD Sport package, so it actually looks pretty tough as opposed to like the small two-wheel drive Tacomas that just look dorky. But it's the Corolla of pickups. You know, it's a product that hasn't been updated to be at the forefront of its segment, but it's still a decent vehicle.
The last Tacoma I drove was that TRD TX off-road limited edition
truck. That is a whole lot of acronyms.
It was. And it was funny because they kept saying it was like their budget Raptor. They never put that on paper, but of course that's what they kept calling it like when we were out on this track.
That's weird. All right, so you go to a Toyota event and they're talking about another automaker's product in reference to theirs?
Under their breath, right?
Yeah, if you could compare something to a Raptor, I mean, that's pretty good. It's like, I don't know, if the FRS felt like a Corvette, I'm sure they would call it a Corvette competitor all the time.
That's a little different, though.
A Raptor is a Corvette. I mean, it's an off-road Corvette, I think of it as. But anyways, that thing was pretty cool. It had a full, I mean, I forget the specs on it, but that thing was meant for off-road. And that's the cool thing I like about the Tacoma and the Frontier. They're still meant, you know, to be a little more rugged. Whereas, you know, I think the future generation.
No, I agree. They're real trucks still. And I think Jeff's totally right. In another 10 years, you know, most of these trucks are going to be unibodies and they're not going to be nearly
front wheel drive, probably.
Yeah. They totally are.
Hey, they're the Rabbit pickup. I mean,
no, Ridgeline.
Nobody thinks of the Ridgeline. So, not an exciting garage this week, but we do have the excitement of the Geneva Auto Show sort of winding up and getting ready. It hasn't really kicked off yet as we record this, but we've seen leaks, and the most striking thing I think that we've seen so far is the Lamborghini Veneno.
We've Veneno. Like called Ven, we probably call it Veneno, but there's probably some cool Italian way to say it.
Well, it's named after a Spanish fighting bull, so it would probably be Veneno.
It's Veneno.
But it doesn't have any squiggly lines in it either.
Yeah, there's no tilde over the N, so I don't know. Maybe.
Do the Italians use tildes?
No, but Lamborghini names its cars after Spanish bulls. And so we have Murcielago, which is probably actually Murcielago if you're pronouncing it correctly.
It's seriously badass.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that's all we really need to know about this latest Lamborghini is it just goes full-on crackhead
and it's just,
bonkers.
But it's so frickin' cool. And everything from its carbon fiber monocoque, it weighs 300 and something pounds less than an Aventador, which is actually a very light Lamborghini. And it's just crazy. Crazy.
Yeah, and
just seriously badass.
Okay, so we're all drooling over this car. There's going to be four total, mm-hmm. right, Jeff? We were talking about this before. It seems like you've got the scoop on it.
Yeah, there's going to be three made for customers selling for 3 million euros, which is roughly translates right now to $3.9 million. And then this one that's in the picture was their test car and show car. So four total in the world will ever be made.
Yeah, and they have just that craziness of the old Lamborghini. I look at this car and I just see Countach. And I'm no fan of the Countach, but I like this thing. And I know that a lot of the commentary on it is going to be that it's ugly. But look at the Veyron. The Veyron's no, you know, beauty queen either. So
I disagree. The Veyron in person. I mean, I'm looking at these pictures from the auto show. Everybody quick, get on Autoblog's page. And you zoom up on these full-size pictures, and you could spend 15 minutes looking at just a quarter panel. Look at the rear picture, the four exhausts, the LEDs, the red lights, the sharp, you know, scissored. It's all, you know, it's that stealth fighter B2 bomber design, the spine going down the back. I mean, it's just gorgeous.
Yeah, I like my two favorite things about the car are the shark fin that pretty much go the entire spine of the car.
Right.
And then the weird wheel openings. The first picture we saw of it, it almost looked like a really bad Photoshop job because they're kind of like oblonged and, you know, different shaped on the front and rear. But, you know, this thing was designed to go 220 miles an hour, so I'm sure every little bit of aero was tweaked on this car.
See, the thing that this car reminds me of is just, it's that Lamborghini swagger. You know, like, the whole company is born from, oh, you don't want to treat me with respect because I bought one of your cars? You're gonna be a jerk? I'm just going to go make a car that beats yours. And I mean, that's the whole company's sort of founding ethos. And I remember the first time I saw a Countach, and I was just like, in pictures, and it was just like, what is that? And especially because it was in the 80s, so it wasn't the original sort of smoother design. It was the 80s aero kit. not the later anniversary edition. It was the 5000, LP5000. Anyway, it was just crazy. It had the same kind of vents in the engine deck lid as this car does. It had the scissor doors. It had all these surfaces that just looked like they would draw blood at any given point in time. And this car seems to return to some of that craziness. Even the funky wheel openings, if you look at the Countach, it has those as well. It's got completely mismatched wheel arches, and it just looks strange, but it's just so crazy, and I think that's part of the Lamborghini charm. And if you want a smoother Lamborghini, there was another Lamborghini concept debuted as well that has that classic early 70s.
I don't want to talk about that yet.
Oh, I really like that, though.
Hang on a second. I don't know if they've announced who designed this this brand new. You know, we're only going to make four or five of these Lamborghini. But the Aventador was designed by Filippo Parini. And I was actually lucky enough to sit down and have dinner with him about a month ago, back when I was driving the Aventador. And the guy is just so passionate about design on every single square inch of that on the Aventador. You know, he I actually walked him outside and said, you know, let's talk about the car. And we spent 45 minutes to an hour just going over every square inch of the car. And it's just fascinating to sit and listen to a designer that's not saying, well, you know, I've got the people that are worrying about where this part of the Camry has to be done. You know, you go to talk to a Toyota designer, they're like, well, it had to be a blob and had to have four wheels and seat four or five passengers. And this guy was like, no, I sculpted this because it looks badass. And he was literally, he said that, you know, this just looks cool.
Yeah, and I have to loved say, it. The Aventador is one of the best-looking Lamborghinis to come along in about 25 years. Because they went from these edgy, brash cars to a very 90s sort of soft-cornered, big, portly thing with the Diablo. That car was in such a difficult spot from the get-go. It had to follow up this outrageous car and try to be more outrageous, and it was almost like the beginning of you know, abstract art. It's like when you've done all of those things that you can logically think of to do, what do you do next? And you go completely illogical.
Where do they go after this Veneno thing? I mean, this is as crazy as you can get on a road car.
Well, this is their 50th anniversary car, so you know. They turned 50 and they had a wild party, and then, you know, we'll see where they go from here.
I mean, as a guy who washes his own cars, this thing's going to drip for 4 hours straight after you wash it. I'm looking at all those things. It could take 60 towels to dry this thing.
Like, you just take it out and drive it.
Oh, yeah. But it's so gorgeous.
You just it blow is all so that water right off it. It is a Lamborghini supercar in the proper sense, and you know what, crazy fast.
When I first saw it, I mean the vertical headlights, and you know, I hate calling this thing an Audi, but Audi is the parent company of Lamborghini, and Audi's been talking about making a road version of their LMP1 car, and this just looks like a car that you could take. Well, it was made to take to a racetrack or drive on the street. It's probably gonna end up in three garages.
You're totally right, Jeff, especially when you start looking at the spine and things like that. You know, those are things that we've seen in Audi's race cars.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, the more you look at it and the more you think about the Audi, you know, the Volkswagen Group relationship, you do see that stuff.
And look at the door mirrors. Those definitely look like prototype door mirrors.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, none of that's a bad thing. I don't think the relationship with Volkswagen and Audi and all of that is a
no,
bad
it's
thing.
Helped them.
To compare this thing to a car we're going to see racing all over the world, I mean, that's definitely not a bad thing.
See, now, here's the thing, though. Like, Lamborghini has typically made these ridiculous high-performance supercars, but they shy away from racing. Do you think that we're going to start to see them edge actually into racing?
Well, not with this. They recently, they're doing a Gallardo GT3 FL2. It's going to be, I don't know what series it's going to race in, but they're going to have their own series for it too, a spec series. So, I mean, they're trying to get back into racing. I mean, I don't think you're going to see this guy ever race on a track.
Yeah, probably not. Paint. Yeah.
No, they race the Gallardos, and Bentley's actually getting into racing also. Or getting back into racing.
Yeah, getting back.
A lot of these guys have raced before, and the readers are saying, you know, Lambos have been raced in the past.
Yes,
but,
they have.
Racing is so expensive these days for automakers, especially after all the recession and
but
stuff.
But Lamborghini didn't start off as a race car. Like, Ferrari was the Fiat race team.
Right.
And he started building road cars to support his, when he went independent, he started building road cars to support his race team. They were sort of the throwaway things, and now it's flipped, and the Ferrari road cars is sort of where all the focus is. Lamborghini didn't really start that way.
I don't think Lamborghini has anything to prove either. You know, a lot of automakers race to prove themselves. You know, they're selling every Lamborghini they make right now.
Yeah, well, and I think Ferrari sells every Ferrari they can make.
Yeah.
But I don't think racing hurts any of
York's selling every Verona they make right now.
But not every LaCrosse.
Yeah, well, there's a reason for that. But you don't want to talk about the parkour?
Yes, we do. Now let's talk about it.
My God, that thing is gorgeous.
No, it's good looking. Hang on, let me go back.
And it's like a little four-wheel drive I don't know. It has some of those classic early 70s concept car cues in it.
It almost has a little, you're going to hate me if I say this, you know, almost a little bit of a Mustang Camaro front to it, too, when I look at it.
It does. Really I see some sort of French and Italian kind of...
The back end, no, but the front is just... It's cool.
Yeah. I like that thing. And we don't really have a ton more that we need to say about it. But it's an off-road sort of version of the Gallardo. So, I mean, that's kind of cool. Like, say what you will about SUVs and crossovers, you drive a four-wheel drive Lamborghini Outback.
Oh, come on. I'd look at this thing driving down the road before I look at a VW Beetle.
And you'd see the 85-year-old guy driving it.
Oh, you're right. The old bald guy slowly driving it.
Going 20. So while we're on the subject of Geneva, let's just touch a little bit on what's there besides the Volkswagen showcase, which was why we're talking about.
I think we should deliberately not talk about the Volkswagen XL1.
Yeah, the Volkswagen XL1 is mileage. Woohoo.
We'll talk about it. Hang on, guys.
I will talk about the XL1 more later.
Okay, what are you going to talk about now?
What's your favorite thing from Geneva that you've seen so far?
Oh, come on. I'm a GT3. And, you know, and I'm talking, what's my favorite thing that's real world that I'll be able to drive someday in a, alone? GT3. I can't wait to drive the new GT3.
I just think the Geneva show has been such a standout for design lately. I mean, and this year is no different. You know, you see all like great designs coming from all corners too. Like we were just talking about the Lamborghini stuff, but Kia, the Provo concept, that thing looks awesome. And I know that part of that is the fact that they have a very good designer sort of heading up their design, but that's going to be cool when it actually makes to a road car.
You know, the crazy thing is, if you look at the shows we've had, you know, starting with Los Angeles this year so far, the Vet came out. We've had some major debuts, but this Geneva show just seems to be hitting the ball out of the park as far as, you know, like you said, design, cars, you know, this is the show of the year. It's really an amazing show so far. And it hasn't, you know, what does it start in? Starts, 3 hours, technically?
Yeah, I was going to say it starts tomorrow, but it starts today.
No, I like the Provo concept. Really, really good looking.
Yeah. All right. So, and let's talk about the XL1 here. Lightweight, low drag. Supposed to get 261 miles per gallon. It's a concept car that they're testing.
It's made it to the production form.
Yeah, that's.
It reminds me a lot of what the was the EV1.
That's what I was going to say. It looks like an EV1.
Especially when you look at our pictures, the fifth thumbnail or something, where you have the rear three-quarter view, it's a lot of EV1. But I think it's kind of cool looking.
Yeah.
Jetsons looking car.
It's that's what we see too at these shows. You see like these bonkers performance concept cars, and half of them are these really great looking, wonderfully realized supercars that are hybrids, and that makes me upset. And then we've got the other side, the flip side, which is these super efficient vehicles that are pushing the envelope in a different way, and they're not only moving the technology, but design and packaging and thinking about how to be more efficient. So we've got these two masters that we serve, and it's just an interesting thing. We've seen this pick up more and more at shows, and especially in a European show. There's got to be a lot of stuff on the floor there in Geneva that's just completely tilted towards the green side of things, or I guess blue now, because blue is the new green. But
I like the obviously I like the Corvette Stingray convertible.
That's where I was going. I was going to say
really good looking.
I'll take the XL1 and I will see you the Stingray convertible.
Yeah.
See, my favorite was the RS6 Avant.
Oh yeah, that's a really really nice one too. In fact, because the S6 is one of my favorite cars today on the road today. So
you have expensive taste in cars. How is it that you can afford these things?
I'm a really old guy.
Yeah, we were talking about cars that we could actually drive and afford, and I was thinking along the lines of the Golf station wagon that was unveiled. I might be able to afford that.
It'd be a stretch.
Yeah. I have to move some things around my overseas accounts.
Yeah. The RS6 is amazing, and the nice thing is that Audi always is very conservative with acceleration numbers. So we're talking, that's like a 3.5 second car.
What? I have not had the opportunity to drive too many cars that accelerate that ferociously.
It's just, yeah, it's crazy fast. It's fun fast, though. It's one of those things where you just start giggling, and it's a blast. But it has a launch control. The S6 got a hidden launch control feature where you do a couple things to the pedals real quickly, and you can blast off. All-wheel drive obviously gets you there. And the way the engine delivers it, you know, its torque and all-wheel drive, it just flies. But keep in mind that the E63 is now the 4MATIC. They're also all-wheel drive. So it's obviously leaving a BMW in their M5 sitting there with their rear wheels spinning. It'll be interesting to see how long before a BMW decides to put their X-Drive on their M5.
I wonder if they'd call it the MX5.
And they'll do MX5. They'll lower the price. It'll be a mid-$20,000 car.
Yeah, Roadster.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, we should, now that we're talking about BMW slightly, we should talk about the 3 Series and perennial challengers to the 3 Series, like Infiniti and Mercedes. And now we've got a new one trying to come up and grab a little bit of that spotlight. We've seen spy shots of a Jaguar 3 Series contender. Do you think that's a good move for Jaguar?
If they can do it better than the X-Type, definitely.
Now, the X-Type, do you think the X-Type was really a bad car?
It wasn't. It was Ford.
It was a front-wheel
platform engineering at its worst.
Yeah.
It was Ford trying to be like GM from the 80s.
Had a much better interior than...
I'm not saying it was a bad interior. It was just a feeble excuse for a Jaguar.
Mike, you don't look at people driving X-Types?
Not really.
Okay.
But I think that Jaguar, I'm a big fan of the XJ, and I think Jaguar should continue to do what they do best, is the really high-end luxury cars. I'm a little concerned about them going after the 3 Series, because I don't see the 3 Series buyer saying, you know what, I was going to get a 328, but instead I'm going to buy a Jaguar.
But you don't think so? You don't think that there's an allure for something different?
No, not something different. I think they're looking for something sporty. If you notice how the Cadillac ATS, you know, really has to push its sporty traits over its luxury traits. And I think Jaguar, right off the bat, you know, yeah, you've got the R-types and things like that. But I just think that the average, you know, 25 to 35-year-old, you know, college-educated guy with, you know, making six figures.
Okay, first of all, that scenario... That's not the average.
I didn't say
your average. Except for the six-figure part? Yeah.
I don't think these guys are... We'll see.
But I think with the addition of the F-Type, you know, another small car will definitely... You know, because you get the F-Type to drag them in, and then like, I don't need a two-seat Roadster. But, oh, look, here's a little sedan that I could get, you know, just as much performance out of.
Well, but we also have to remember, and Jeff, you know, what Jeff was, I think, going that, is that we also have to remember the European market, where smaller cars fare better. And, you know, that could be the next big Jaguar over in, you know, overseas.
Yeah, the only problem with Europe right now is that they're not buying any cars.
Right.
Yeah, they're not buying anything. And, yes, their auto market is larger than the U.S. when you combine all the countries, but they're currently in a tougher situation. The thing that Jaguar really needs to do, though, is they need to make money. And, you know, so they've got the XF and they've got the XJ and they've got the Roadsters, but those are all sort of clustered up above $50,000. So they don't have anything that can sort of come down a little bit in price. You know, it's very much like we saw the birth of brands like Plymouth and Pontiac. You offer the slightly lower priced option that's still a very good car and does all the things that the brand needs it to do. And yeah, there's some obvious trade-offs. You know, it'll be smaller. I'm sure that it won't be as sumptuous as the XJ. But on the other hand, it's going to be in a size that it sells really well. You know, the best-selling BMW sedan is the 3 Series, right? So why not go for that? And you make enough buzz when you go after that car anyway. Look what it's done for the ATS. And
but look at who this thing is going to compete with. The CLA is going to be right there. So now you have a 3 Series. You got the CLA. You have, you know, all these really, really good little cars. You know, the A4 is a good car, a great car.
Yeah.
You got the Cadillac.
Importantly, they're not Jaguars. There's a lot of cachet to that name. And
which is why they can't really afford to do something too budget-minded. I mean, they can't be making a car just to
lower the entry-level.
They can't just be doing it to lower the price point. They have to make this a small XF or XJ.
And that's going to be really tough for them because once you get the parts, the pieces that make up a car to a certain cost, they don't really get any cheaper. You can make the car smaller, it's still going to cost just as much to build. I mean, it's the same thing with the pickup trucks, right? That's why there's not really any more compact pickup trucks because they can sell a bigger truck for more money and make more profit, and it costs just as much as this. Anyway.
Is this a rear-wheel drive platform?
I believe it will be, yeah. It's their new architecture.
PLA architecture.
Yeah, right. And that's the thing. Like, they have to execute it correctly. The X Type was their pass. They're not going to get a pass again if they execute that way. But importantly, they're also going to build an SUV or a crossover off the same platform, and that's going to be coming soon after the car. And I think that's where the money's going to come.
But honestly, I would rather see a small 3 Series fighting sedan than an SUV. Because then, my problem with Jaguar and Land Rover, these two companies have been so close together for so long that then where do you separate the two? Like, if you get a small Jaguar crossover, then you have the LR2 and the Evoque sitting right there too.
Yeah, the Evoque is kind of a problem. The LR2 is kind of a non-issue at this point. That thing, like, I forgot they even still made it.
Well, I'm sure they're going to redesign it.
Too bad. I mean, if you get the Evoque, go with the Evoque.
But was that the Defender in other countries?
Well, the Defender is kind of a niche product, though, too. That's like their Jeep Wrangler.
No, what is the LR2? Oh, the Freelander.
Yeah, the Freelander was the LR2 here, too. They brought the Freelander to the U.S. You can buy one really cheap because the engines sort of have issues and blow up, and they're kind of...
I like the Evoque.
Non-repairable.
I love the Evoque.
I like the way it looks. Everything else I'm all set with.
I can't wait to see the Evoque platform.
Why don't they use the Evoque platform? The Evoque platform is it's a Ford platform, and I think one of the other things Jaguar needs to do is get away from licensing a platform and intellectual property from another automaker that they no longer are beholden to. It's the same thing that Geely's doing with Volvo. They're developing their own platform because they right now their current product is on this old platform that Ford owns. So I'm sure they're paying money to Ford for the ability to use that as a separate brand. But I don't know. I think you do have a little bit of difficulty with a Jaguar crossover, but I think that overall they'll figure that out where it fits within the, like, I don't think you're going to have like a Jaguar Land Rover competitor because, you know, Range Rover is Range Rover and, you know, an LR4 is a family vehicle. Well, how do you make Jaguar fit there? I mean, do you make it go after like a Cayenne?
Yeah, I would hope that, you know, if they're going to push ahead with the 3 Series Challenger, I would hope they kick serious butt doing it. I just don't want to see another half-ass attempt. And that's my fear, is that they can hurt themselves easier than they can help themselves. They really have to hit a home run, especially when you set your sights on the 3 Series. I mean, look how good the ATS is.
Yeah, the ATS is arguably still better,
right?
But it
still hasn't dethroned the champion.
Yeah, it's a game of inches at that point.
Right, but it's so, so good. And look how much money GM put in that car. And, you know, Jaguar has to understand, okay, if we're going to climb that mountain, you know, that's a lot of investment. And for what? You know, what's the ROI? You know, how many of those 3 Series Challengers are you going to sell? You know, we're better off putting the money in a the new XK coupe or whatever it is.
So yeah, they got to update the XK soon, please. Get rid of the fish face. That's another car. It's like the Evoque. I don't get why people love it so much because it's just eh.
I've only driven the XKRS.
I drove the XKRS on Nürburgring.
Okay, all right. I can get behind that.
And fine. it drove bah.
Yeah, fine. I understand that entirely. I really love the supercharged XKs, but not for that kind of money. I think there's
Jeff, what'd you think of it?
I did not drive it on the Nürburgring. I drove it
to Golden Corral.
No, yeah, I drove it around Jacksonville.
The buffet ring.
Holy cow, man! That thing has so much power to it. It's most of it's unusable in daily driving.
Oh, it's a complete hooligan of a car. It's like it's a British muscle car, you know.
Yeah,
and it's great for what it is, but it's also like just not that great.
When I drove it, I think I didn't shift out of second gear most of the time because keeping it in that exhaust note range, that's all I wanted. I wanted to rattle some windows.
I do love the way that thing sounds. Yeah, so I don't know. Jaguar's got to bring it, and they've got to do it right, and it's going to cost them a lot of money, but I think the upside is, and they're looking at that, and I think the upside is probably something that they have calculated to be better because, you know, also thinking about Europe, drive a car the size of an XF even in Europe, thanks, Kat. It's difficult to get around in some places where a 3 Series size car fits, so. Yeah, so anyway, we are brought to you by TireRack.com, the leading online source for tires and so much more, including a large selection of winter tires, as well as aftermarket wheels, suspension, and brake components, and those items that make it easier to see, like windshield wipers and replacement lighting. So no matter what your vehicle, check them out at TireRack.com. Let's move on to another case of sort of taking what's great and making it cheap in the hopes that it's, and these are just rumors, but I don't know if this is going to pan out for Chevrolet. What do you think, Jeff?
Well, for
the low cost Corvette model.
Yes.
Is that what we're talking about? Yeah. I didn't know if I was reading the right thing. It could definitely use a lower model. I mean, I remember when the C5 came out with the coupe version, and that was the whole point of it. And then that kind of morphed into the Z06 body, and you know, it created a lot more excitement about the car. I don't think you're going to need any excitement for the C7, but you know, if they could get a sub $50,000 Corvette, I mean, that would be okay. Good for the company.
No,
but I think the base C7 as it sits, as we've seen it, is the performance bargain of the century.
It's
going to kick butt over every Porsche. I'll tell you, I mean, every normal sub $90,000 Porsche at this point, it's going to kick butt over everything right now. It is by far the bargain. And my fear is when you start, if you try to lower it and get a $49,000 version, you start taking content out of it. And we consumers are just too stupid to handle something like that. BMW tried it years and years ago when they sold, like, they called them lightweights, you know, no air conditioning, no radios.
The CSLs.
And the people want it, you know, someone walks in the showroom and say, "Why do you mean no power windows? I want those back in. What do you mean no Bluetooth? I want that back in." And pretty soon, all of a sudden, now you have your $55,000 entry level Corvette again.
But Porsche did that brilliantly with the Boxster Spyder. They were like, "Oh no, you're going to pay to take all this stuff out. Oh, you want
because it
back
wasn't
in? We'll charge you extra to put the radio back in."
Yeah, Porsche is the only people who can charge more for their coupe than their convertible with the Cayman and the Boxster. Think about that.
Porsche can do a lot of whatever the heck it wants.
But I would love to see, you know, a lightweight Corvette for $49,999, whatever you want to charge. Engine, suspension, brakes, roll-up windows. Please, that would be so cool.
I don't think they even engineered roll-up windows. You're going to have
to... But you can lean over. Right? You're right.
Or just Lexan inserts.
Right.
But you're right. There exists no mechanism or tooling for roll-up windows anymore.
Yeah, I see, the problem that a lot of people have with this that I don't agree with, and I don't think you guys will agree with me, especially you, Mike, because I know you drive a lot of high performance cars on the track. Even a lot of folks are saying, "Oh, a cheaper Corvette, that's the Camaro," and it's like, no.
No, not even close.
Two completely different things.
Yeah, not even close.
Yeah. The Camaro is, yes, it costs less, but it also doesn't do anything like the Corvette does.
And I drove, I don't know if you remember, I drove the LS1 Camaro. I actually took it to a Porsche track event and was passing every Porsche out there. And the Camaro was one badass mofo. I mean, I would just come right up to these little 911s and just, you see these big headlights and they'd move to the side and I was passing them. You know, the thing was pulling like 1.1, 1.2 G's.
Fingers.
Just an incredible car. But the Corvette is so different than a Camaro. A Camaro is a huge tank that just sticks like glue and it just, they're very, very different cars, night and day. And yeah. So don't ever let anyone try to convince anyone out there that, the poor man's Corvette is a Camaro. Absolutely not. No different than, the poor man's Ford GT is a Mustang. And no, very different cars.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody's ever said that about the Ford GT. I hope not.
The Ford GT wasn't even that expensive either. It was like, what, 100 grand? Were they?
No, I think they're up there like 150, 170. I don't know.
Yeah. They need to come back with that. But I don't know that the Corvette is actually very expensive now, given what it does. And I think that's the point you guys are making.
No, you're being, for the true enthusiast who wants to go track a car, to drop 50 grand, 55 grand. I mean, there are, an Acura MDX is 50 grand.
Yeah, and I'd much rather have a Corvette.
Yeah.
Oh, I really do like the MBX. I've got a nice man crush on that.
Maybe I'll pick a different car for you. How about the Volvo XC90?
Absolutely not.
The 2003.
Yeah.
The Acura ILX Premium is 30 grand. For 20 grand more, you're talking vet territory.
Yeah, or just wait a couple of years and you're talking vet territory already with that same money. I mean, that's the thing. A cheap Corvette is a used Corvette, and you know they're lightly used. It's like buying a Harley, right? You can always find something that's barely been touched and it's just mint condition, and then you can drive it away and just mercilessly wail on it.
Yeah, there's some guy that has bought a C6 and it's mint condition, and he has maybe 2,000 miles on it, and he waxes it with he's got Q-tips and a bottle of wax, and that's all he does.
It's been stored on jack stands so the tires don't flat spot.
And he doesn't realize the resale value was still, 23 grand or something on it. Yeah, but
it's like, don't buy something that's not rare and treat it like it's the Hope Diamond. It's just drive it.
You can buy a car and treat it well.
Yeah, but I can't wait to drive the C7. I think it's absolutely going to knock the ball out of the park completely.
See, and, we keep talking about the lower end. I can't wait to see what comes on the higher end of this. I mean, the Stingray is supposed to be like the base Corvette for now. So, I mean, just think what starts happening when we come out with, I don't know if they're coming back out with Z06 and ZR1. And
they'll come out with all that stuff. The ZR1's going to be, that's just going to have to be something incredible.
And then Hennessy's coming out with a 1,000 horsepower Corvette.
The ZR1, the current ZR1, I think, the last vet rolled off the line, right?
Yeah,
last week.
The last year's ZR1 was only limited by traction. And I don't think Corvette's not going all-wheel drive on us. But
wouldn't that be cool?
I mean, what are they going to do to put that power to the ground? I mean, what are they going to have, 638 horsepower right now, the current ZR1?
Yes.
So they're going to go up to 700 horsepower?
I hope
650, so. 675?
I hope 7. I hope we get 7.
We've got two wheels and a contact patch, 335s in the back. I mean, you just can't put that power to the ground.
700 horsepower in a production car. Just how good does that sound?
Delicious.
Sounds great to me. I love supercharged V8s. I really do. We should move on to some questions before we get all dewy over the Corvette that we haven't even driven yet. But let's stick with tuners.
Nobody's driven yet.
Yeah. Let's stick with tuners. We got a question in on the Q&A. Do you believe a car's value is improved or damaged when worked on by tuners such as Mansory, Fab Design, or Heyman? Please consider performance design, production numbers, and past examples, if possible. Okay.
Let me weigh in on this, because people ask this question all the time. One argument says you are actually hurting resale value.
That's my argument.
And let me give you an example here.
Ugly.
Let's say we're going to go buy a pair of 501. let's back up. Say you're going to go buy a pair of 501 jeans. You take them home, and all of a sudden you decide, you know what? I want the pocket a little bigger for my cell phone. So you cut a 4-inch hole in the pocket to get the cell phone in and out. And then you decide that your boots don't fit on your right leg, so you cut around the hem. You hem them 3 inches higher on the right leg. Now for you, those jeans are just perfect.
Also, but, though, wait. 501s, that means button fly. First of all, you're stupid. Button. Okay, second, move on.
My point is, the second you start customizing a car, you're limiting your audience. And, you may like the M3, but you may not like the M3 with the 15-inch spoiler on the back and the 27-spoke wheels. Now, that said, if you go and have your car worked on by Roof or Roush or one of those tuners, that could add value. But once again, you're only adding value to the person that appreciates, the work that Roush does, or Saline or something like that. So, that's my two.
I mean, at the same time, do people really buy cars like that looking at resale value? I mean, most of the time you think resale value on a family car or something that you replace a lot. I mean, if you're going to go out and get, a 911 tuned by somebody, I guess that kind of person has the money to blow, so maybe they're not even looking for resale value. I don't know where the trade-off would be at that point.
Yeah, I just think, like, stuff like the Heyman stuff and Mansory is just, like, just crush every single one of those god-awful, hideous monstrosities. I have no problem with going and adding extra performance to these things and tweaking. The problem I have really extends to the disgusting styling that they tend to do with these vehicles. They always, even the ones that are, like, from tuners that I respect for their ability to tune the car, they always have, like, terrible chrome wheels on them, and just it's got to be the owners that just have this, like, bourgeois sense of style. It's terrible. It's like, hey, I won the lottery. Let me make something completely awful.
Well, it's like the Cadillacs from the 80s when they added all that gold trim to it, I guess.
But if you're gonna do the upgrades, try to be tasteful. Ask four of your friends first before you do it. Before you paint the wheels pink or anodize the antenna. And
four friends in different parts of your life too, not all in the same group.
And ask Dan's cat.
Ask your mom.
Yeah, right. You're right. Don't just ask your four friends at school. Ask two adults and two other guys.
And your boss. Ask your boss.
A Facebook poll.
And then if they all like it, then go ahead.
Yeah, so, all right. I think we've decided that we don't really like tuners other than the performance tuners. Like,
well, even then, I mean, anytime you touch a car, I mean, it's creating what you want. And, I mean, you could take a GTR, make 1,000 horsepower, full carbon fiber body kit, excellent custom interior. That thing could look show quality perfect.
Yeah, you'd have to make it hella flush.
But I mean,
I'm gonna go puke.
It's just people want what they want, and it everyone has their own taste, I guess.
Yeah, most of it bad.
Especially hella flush.
Yeah. Let's just hit this one briefly and move on. What do you think the chances are of Lincoln coming out with a full-size long wheelbase rear-wheel drive sedan in the next 2.5 years? Next Zero. 2 to 5 years?
Zero.
Yeah.
Okay. Negative 15.
And I don't think that's the key to that brand surviving. I don't think that brand's going to survive. And that's
no, did you see our by the numbers? I mean, Lincoln is the low anchor.
But Saab sold more.
Kesha.
I mean, isn't MKZ, aren't they still ramping up production or something like that? I've heard like dealers can't get MKZs on lots.
Okay.
Yeah, the reason why they're ramping up production on the MK, they want to make sure that it launches correctly, so they are holding supply until they get the cars right.
And not have 55 recalls like the Fusion.
Yeah, I think they're...
Then, I mean, if they can do the Escape, whatever, the MKC, and if they can get rid of MK names, okay.
Yeah, but the MKC is not here for quite a while still, but... I know that they've got an issue that they're quietly working on the MKZ would be my guess.
Well, the second part of the question, is there any way Lincoln can realistically survive as a luxury maker without such a vehicle?
Absolutely. Absolutely they can. They don't need a rear-wheel drive car.
But they need something. They need a good product to stand out. Yeah.
Right. Like something unique. I agree with you. Yeah.
I agree with that completely, but...
It doesn't have to be a big sedan. It doesn't have to be a sporty coupe. It could be some wacky anything. It has to be good. It can't feel like a Ford. It has to, you know, be great in everything it does.
Yeah, it's got to be a Lincoln. And
yeah,
and it should come with a top hat and a beard.
I have one of those things. And it's not the top hat. So, Dari, I'm not going to kick Lincoln anymore.
There was a long pause there.
Yeah.
Is he wearing a top hat or does he have a beard?
I do the podcast in tails, really. I get all dressed up. Yes, in a monocle. I dress up like the Monopoly man for the podcast. It's the only time I feel rich and masterful of my domain. But Jim asks a very good question, and that is, why is drifting fun? And drifting is fun because...
Because it's everything you're not allowed to do on public roads. That's why. Because you're absolutely going sideways. You're using horsepower. You're making smoke. You're making noise. You're shredding tires. It's everything a dude wants to do. You're just being badass.
It's the borderline, and most of the time, loss of control, too.
Yeah.
Like, you're just pushing it so far to the edge.
Excitement. It's everything.
I like the just relative antisocial aspect of it. I really like it. Because usually, like, a lot of the people who attempt drifting are not actually at a drifting event.
Right.
They're in, like, a mall parking lot.
For its fuel efficiency.
Yeah. And that's a really great place to learn vehicle dynamics. I know I did in the rain. Back.
And we have to thank Drifting for excellent YouTube videos, because so many of our Reader Tip YouTube videos are excellent drifting skills.
Yeah, and I get bored with drifting really fast because it's just like it's glorified donuts.
Have you gone to a Formula Drift event?
No, don't get me wrong. It takes
skill. You have to come out to one. I was one of those guys that hated drifting. Like... I hated drifting. You know, readers out there, go to one Formula Drift event, and you'll come back, you'll smell like soot. But it's such a cool event. They're actually very entertaining.
They're completely entertaining, but it's just
like... You see carnage. You see rubber flying through the air. You see crashes. It's noisy. It's fun.
It's got to be difficult as a driver, too. Like, Mike, I bet you'd have trouble initially.
I tried it. Hyundai tried to teach me how to drift at the Genesis launch. And
That's a hard car to drift anyway.
I could do about 3/4 of a circle, and I'd autocorrect. I automatically correct.
Yeah, because it's
counterintuitive, right?
Yeah, it's everything you're taught not to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's
so just, it takes a lot of skill, and I can't do it, so... But I got invited to drift a semi.
A tractor trailer. That would just be awesome.
So one of these days you'll have me back and I will have drifted a tractor trailer, I guess. A tractor, I guess they call it.
You must do that. Whoever invited you to that, you must call
them. Crazy.
Do it now. Let's call it. What's their number? We'll conference them in.
I'm going to look through my email. But I'm like, yes, with all caps. Not with a trailer, somebody has. No.
Oh, no, not with a trailer, because that's a pretty easy way to get it sideways. all right.
Go ahead.
Grant wants to know if he's the only one who's excited that Spyker's coming out with a new car. Yes.
Yes, you are. That's it. Sorry, Grant.
I'm sure Spyker's executives are excited.
Yeah, even that whole sob thing. Now, let's just not talk about that. So, all right, one more from the Q&A, and it's, should Ford revive the Thunderbird model name with a four-door coupe based on the next-gen Mustang?
If they did it right?
No. It sounds like that's a bad idea.
The Thunderbird has been a bad car since its early days.
No, it was a good car when it was...
No. I totally agree with Jeff. We have not seen a good Thunderbird in 30 years.
The 90s Thunderbirds, the last Suck. Real Thunderbirds...
Those were awesome.
They were great. Suck. They're fun. But
oh, come on.
I would much rather have a Mustang.
I would... Okay, if we're talking like cars from that era, I would really love to have a Thunderbird Super Coupe. Shut up. Way more than...
Do you know how slow the Ford Thunderbird Super Coupe was?
The Thunderbird Super Coupe was like 8 seconds. 8 seconds. How fast was the LX5O? Everything was slow then.
But that was the... what do they call it? The ninth generation. You're going to hear the curb weight in that thing. That had the... It was the same engine as the Mercure, I think. The X-040i.
No. The Super Coupe had the supercharged Essex V6. So, there.
Okay, it had the SVO engine.
No.
Yes, it did.
Supercharged Essex V6.
Ford Thunder Coupe.
Thunderbird Super Coupe. You had the Turbo Coupe, which was the Fox body. When they went to the independent rear-end Thunderbird in 89 and brought out the Super Coupe, it had an Eaton supercharger on the 3.8-liter V6.
Okay, I'll believe you.
But still.
But I wonder what it weighed.
It weighed like 4,000 pounds. It was heavy.
When all the other cars of that era were like 2,800 to 3,000 pounds. It was a tank.
But it was also just awesome.
But there's no real name recognition as far as like the cache of the Thunderbird name anymore. I mean, it's not like the Camaro where they could bring it back after it died and then make it a four-door coupe. They could really do anything with a Thunderbird as long as it kind of had that personal luxury feel, I guess. They couldn't do any wrong with it.
Yeah, I don't know. They went horribly retro with that last Thunderbird. So
I'm sure that
tarnished the name.
I'm sure a lot of people would like to forget that thing.
Also, is anybody interested in the name Thunderbird anymore on a car? Like, I just don't feel like the people who want that are like they've already got their last car that they're ever going to buy.
You imagine walking in this room. This is the last car we're ever going to buy. I think we need a Thunderbird.
We always think that used to be back in the day.
That used to be the tagline for the Thunderbird, didn't it?
That's the last car you'll ever buy.
That was the Pinto.
No, and now it's the Shelby GT500.
I think the Thunderbird, you know, had that last Thunderbird, the most recent Thunderbird, I don't even know when it disappeared, but the 10th generation, 11th generation? I think it was 10th, it was the 11th generation. 2002 to 2005. Had that thing come out with some kick butt, you know, V8 that would just lay rubber all the way down the street, even though it did have 250 something horsepower. But I don't know. It just was never Thunderbird. And it was a little soft, very feminine looking, especially the front end.
Well, it was supposed to look like the 50s Thunderbird, which was like anytime you decide to do that, that's such a slippery slope, and only a few manufacturers can do that. And
Mustang looks, but
right, but they're going to have to evolve that. The next Mustang will not be like that.
Yeah, give me that.
I thought I'd lost you for a minute.
No, I'm here.
So, all right. We'll go with one question from email that we actually went over a little bit amongst ourselves. So we got this email from Garrick in Milwaukee. I hope I pronounced your name correctly. Now that Chunk's gone, I'm the one who's mangling names. He's looking to buy a car in the next few months, and he has a pretty specific idea of what he wants. He's got a $20,000 max budget, and he lives in a large city. Is Milwaukee actually a large city?
Cat says yes.
Cat, I'm going to murder him. So anyway, he wants to be able to seat four. Hatchback will be nice, but not required. And he's going to use it as his daily driver for the next decade. So he likes the Dart, the Focus, when he looked at the Dart, the Focus, the Mazda 3, didn't like the interior in the Focus, doesn't like the front end of the Mazda 3. So really, he's down to a used C30 or a new Dart. Quite the conundrum. So I throw that to you guys. What
Dart.
Dart.
Dart. Dart.
Jeff? Between those two, Dart for sure.
Yeah, but, yeah, Dart.
Like we talked about before, $20,000 is going to buy you a lot of stuff, especially if you're willing to go used. I mean,
my advice, I agree with Jeff 100% here. In fact, just say it for me, Jeff. If you're going to go use $20,000 to buy you, you know, the world's your oyster at that point. You agree? I mean,
yeah, I mean, because at that point, I mean, if you want a little bit bigger of a four-seater or a little bit smaller with more options, I mean, if you're willing to go used, that is always the best for buying whatever you want to buy. I mean, just go anywhere and look.
Yeah, but wanting to buy that is like a C30. Like, I've driven the C30. I like it. You just had one recently, but it's just... Damn it. It's just a guy.
That sounded like it was in your microphone.
Yeah, he's on my lap.
Take the cat off your lap.
I'm trying to pat him to shut him up.
I don't see how you could compare a C30 and a Dart or any of those cars. I mean, you're talking about two different classes. The Dart, Focus, Mazda 3, those are all like affordable little compacts. The C30 is a...
Well, the C30 is a Mazda 3 hatch, like, or a Mazda 3.
Expensive. Like,
yeah, it is. And that's the thing. Like, every time somebody asks me, and, I'm a Volvo driver, I own them. So people are like, well, what do you think of the C30? I'm like, just buy a Mazda 3. Buy a SkyActiv Mazda 3 and be happy you did, because it's a great car. It has all the stuff that makes every C1 car great and none of the stupidity of a European mark. So
if you got $20,000, you can walk into a dealer and buy a CPO car, you know, for $18,000-$19,000 price point for a CPO car that was, you know, 3 or 4 years ago that was a mid $30,000 car. You're gonna have a 100,000-mile warranty, and you're gonna have a really, really nice car. That's what I would do. I would not
buy you a Boxster. And
you could buy a really nice Boxster, but the maintenance will kill you. But you could buy a really nice used E90 for $20,000.
But he does, like, remember, he wants to keep this for a decade. So, like, with an E90, I have a feeling, like, at a certain point, you're going to hit that, and it's not going to take a decade to hit it. You're going to hit that $5,000 midlife crisis on it.
If you're going to, yeah, how old's this guy again?
I don't know that he says how old he is.
Put it this way. If he's 20, he's going to change his mind up. He's going to change his mind before a decade's up. If he's 30, he's going to change his mind within the next decade.
Yeah.
I don't believe anyone says, I'm going to buy a car for the next decade if they're less than 50 years old.
Yeah.
But even then, you're not going to buy it for
he's got to be less than 50 years old, because he asked if the C30's association with the Twilight movies should corrupt the car forever. First of all, neither me nor none of my friends and acquaintances have actually taken the time to watch that Twilight movie dreck. I was embarrassed for Volvo that they advertised so heavily tied to that movie.
I mentioned that in my review of the C30.
Yeah. You don't really want to associate your car with vampires and werewolves, do you?
If you're trying to sell little teeny bobbers.
You're trying to sell a $40,000 hatchback.
It's not $40,000. Base price was like $28,000.
Okay, so it's a $30,000 hatchback. I don't know. It just seems ridiculous. But and he's also saying, like, the C30 he would be looking at would have around 40,000 miles for $20,000. That's...
I would buy a really cool... 1 or 2 year old GTI.
Yeah. Yeah, I can get behind that.
CPO 2011 GTI. 4-door GTI or 2-door GTI. That would be a great fun car. You have a lot of fun with it.
They drive the car. I mean, honestly, like, if you... He does also point out that fuel economy is an issue. So, like, really, he wants four different cars in one. So, a TDI Golf or a TDI Beetle. I mean, come on, everybody will look at you then.
Convertible. Bright red.
Yeah.
Or a wig.
I'm pretty partial to the GTI because it has tartan seats. I called them plaid once and somebody corrected me. But any time there's that pattern in an automotive interior, that's just all full of win. And so, yeah, GTI.
So I agree with GTI.
We completely did not answer that question. If you have to choose from the two, choose the Dart, but it's kind of heavy, and you're probably not going to get great fuel economy from it, but you're not going to get great fuel economy from the C30, so...
Well, you're going to... I mean, there's nothing wrong with the fuel economy of a Dart.
It's not great. I found that, like, I was working that car so hard. Like, it's a smooth car, but it's heavy, and it feels so wimpy off the line that I felt the urge to just be pretty brutal to it all the time. Maybe it's just because it's a press car, but it didn't feel like it would be satisfying without wringing its neck all the time, so that probably contributes to not so great fuel economy. If you can control yourself, I guess it's fine. The Dart also has a pretty nice manual transmission, which the C30, well, it has a manual, but it's not pretty nice, so... We've completely just – this question has been answered ad nauseum. We're done. The Autoblog podcast is brought to you by TireRack.com, the leading online source for tires and so much more, including a large selection of winter tires, as well as aftermarket wheels, suspension, and brake components, and those items that make it easier to see, like windshield wipers and replacement lighting. So no matter what your vehicle, check them out at TireRack.com. You can find us at podcast@autoblog.com. We also have Twitter. We are at Autoblog Podcast, all one word. Jeff, you're on Twitter.
Jeffrey N. Ross.
And I am at Boston_Auto. Mike, I don't know if you're on Twitter.
I'm in at Schnell Auto.
Schnell Auto. Schnell!
S-C-H-N-E-L-L-A-U-T-O.
All one word, no underscores.
Yeah.
We're all on Twitter.
Yay. And you can always leave us some feedback on our posts directly. I haven't checked iTunes lately to see who's saying what. I'll look at that. But you know where to find us, and we will see you next week.
Good night.
Good night.